morning, everybody. Can everybody hear me back there? Just here. My voice is carrying back there. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Good. For those who don't know me, my name is Lily Paulus. I'm a senior at Brown University, and I'm here to talk to you about something that I assume is dear to all of your hearts: how much money we're all worth. So this is my thesis for the economics department at Brown. So before we get into the actual research and theory, I want to take a minute to talk about, you not here? So before we get into the actual research and theory, I want to spend a minute talking about what it means to talk about baseball from an economic standpoint. And I want to do that by starting with a couple of slightly modified quotes from the greatest baseball economist who ever lived, Aaron Sorkin. I assume you're all familiar with this quote. It was in every single trailer from a movie that I assume you've all seen 12 times. Your goal should be to buy players, your goal should be to buy wins as cheaply as you can. No matter what team you are, no matter how large your payroll, in any business, including baseball, you want to get the most for your money that you can when you're producing it. So you always want to find a way to maximize your resources in terms of product. Second quote is from Lord John Margery from The West Wing. If anyone in here watched The West Wing, he's a great character. A win is a win even if he wears a green necktie and sings Danny Boy. Now, what I assume that the British diplomat was trying to say with this quote was that wins are fungible, and that as long as you win a game, it doesn't matter how you win it in terms of its value to the team. So, the market for wins, is where we're going to start here, is a fundamental assumption of war, or whatever equivalent stat you use, that wins and players are fungible. If that's not true, then war doesn't make sense. Maybe it's not true, but if that's the case, then we have bigger problems than just this presentation. In a rational market, no player is untradeable. Theoretically, if the Angels ate enough of his contract, they could find someone to take Albert Pujols out of their hands. He could be traded. And on the other side of that, no player is untouchable. It's theoretically possible that someone could make the Angels an offer for Mike Trout that would make it worthwhile to trade him. Unlikely that would happen, but they would be irrational not to listen. And then, given that there are 30 teams competing for wins by players in trading, freighted signings, and what have you, teams are generally price takers in the league market. No single team's impact, if you look at the entire totality of transactions, is large enough to entirely shape the market for the rest of the league. So if you accept all that, there's a fundamental, I'll say it's a truism, of the market for wins, that no team should ever willfully pay more than the market price for a win. If you ever buy a win for more than what you could get otherwise, you're acting irrationally. So if you imagine a team that maybe a win is worth $3 million to them, you should, if the rest of the market is buying wins at $1 million per win, you should never spend $2 million. Even if it's worth it to get a win for $2 million, you can get a win for $1 million. So you're leaving $1 million on the table if you do it that way. On the other hand, if you're a small market team who's consistently buying wins more cheaply than the market, that's not the sign of frugality. That means they're exploiting a market inefficiency. And so the way to value a win is going to be approximately equal to the cost of a win. If teams are anywhere close to rational, then what they're willing to pay for a win is a reflection of what a win is worth to a team. That's more than just revenue, that's also just the effect of wanting to win. It's the owner, you know, caring about putting a good product on the field. We can use the cost of a win as an approximation for how teams value wins. How do you calculate the cost of a win? My method for this was very similar to the one used on Fangraphs that I assume most of you are familiar with. I took, for every season going back to 1996, the first season that was not affected by the last strike, I looked at how many wins players playing under contracts they signed as free agents produced via RA9 WAR from Fangraphs and then Fangraphs' typical offensive WAR, and divided the total salary spent on them by the number of wins to get the cost of a win. The major differences between my method and Dave Cameron's are that I use actual observed wins above replacement rather than predicted, and I categorize wins by the year they were produced, not the years they were acquired. So if you look at a three-year contract, I would have categorized each year differently, whereas the Fangraphs model would categorize it all in the off-season in which it was signed. And for this past season, the cost of a win was about $7 million. $7,030,099 if you're keeping track. But $7 million is fine. For reference, here are my results for every year since 1996. And there are some very interesting things in here that I don't know how to explain, so I'll leave you with the mystery. But there it is. So that implies that if you pay less than $7 million per win this past season, you beat the market. If you pay more than that, you overpaid. And the other implication of this that's going to lead into the rest of what we're going to talk about today is that the implicit value of any Major League Baseball team employee to his or her team is equal to $7 million times the number of wins that he or she contributed to the team last year. Now, usually you think of that in terms of players. But I think there's, if you read between the lines of Aaron Sorkin's entire filmography, there's a hidden message in here, if you combine these two quotes. And that message is, you should think of players in terms of wins, but you needn't think of wins solely in terms of players. Who does that leave? The front office. This is Billy Beane. I assume you all recognize Billy Beane. And the story is detailed in Moneyball, so I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. At the end of the 2002 season, he arranged to trade himself to the Red Sox for a package of two minor league players whom the rest of the league considered to be unexceptional. To Billy Beane and to Paul DePodesta, who was orchestrating the trade from the A's perspective, Kevin Weakless was a valuable prospect whom the A's badly wanted. But to the rest of the league, he was an invaluable asset who had no real, he wasn't worth much to the team. And so Brian Kenny told me to use this line last year. It's like trading the goose for a single golden egg. If you're trading the guy who finds his undervalued players for a single player. Oops. 9 years later, the guy they paid after being turned them down, he actually traded himself to the Cubs, sort of. He went to the Cubs. And there were rumors that the Red Sox were going to demand Trey McNutt, at the time one of their best pitching prospects, for Theo. And the Cubs said no, which is fascinating because if Theo truly is, if a GM really makes that big of a difference, and Theo was really the best GM they could acquire, couldn't he have found three more Trey McNutts to replace him? So what this is implying is that the golden egg is worth more than the goose. Put it another way, Theo is the highest paid non-uniformed team employee in baseball. He gets $3.7 million a year, which implies that there's not a single non-uniformed team employee who's worth more than half of a win because of her team every year. And you can look all the way down the line from the highest paid GMs all the way down to the lowest level where you get insurance entry-level employees. Even if you want to say they're making $70,000 a year, which is way more than I think most of them make, that's less than 1/100th of a win to a team per year, implied by their salary. Why is this the case? The obvious explanation, that I assume you all thought of, is that labor supply is high and it's almost perfectly inelastic. Everyone here wants to work in baseball to some degree, I think most people do. And there are thousands of qualified people who are willing to work for nothing to work in baseball. They just want to work in baseball. They don't care about money. Perfectly inelastic means that the supply of labor is not all responsive to changes in the wage. On the other hand, labor demand is much lower than supply, and it's not quite as inelastic as supply, but it's also pretty inelastic. Teams aren't going to hire a bunch of new employees if the price drops because the price has already dropped so low. A couple of good examples of this, or illustrations of this, Dave Cameron wrote this at the time of the PM negotiations, saying there are a few thousand Ivy League graduates going to work for peanuts and Cracker Jacks, so why would you hire anyone who is more expensive than that? And Joshua Kusnick, who's a player agent, wrote, I think about a month ago, teams always have the advantage when hiring because so many people are willing to work for next to nothing just to get their foot in the door. Here's what this labor market looks like. I made this graph in a highly technical program called Microsoft Sharpie. This is an approximation of what it might look like. You can see this is the horizontal axis here is quantity of labor. The vertical axis is wage. And supply and demand curves are quantity as a function of wage. It kind of weird that they put the axis on the vertical axis. I don't know why they do that. It's just how it is. So you can see that the demand for labor is drops off pretty quickly after you fill the very basic positions towards the left half of the curve. And so there's not much change to be had in demand. But supply just shoots up with the quantity of people wanting to work there. It doesn't change much at all based on how much money they're making. So you get to the very top. That's where you start to see some people who maybe they'll work in baseball, but only if they make a little bit more money. So you have the equilibrium quantity, Q star, and wage, W star. And then that W zero up there is arbitrary, but it's an illustration of what these people might be able to make in another industry if they were to work in something that was not baseball. So the slide's in yellow, that means it's important to remember that list. This conception of the market is rational if and only if these three assumptions hold. These are all very wordy, but I've reduced them to much more easy to understand principles here. First assumption is homogeneity of value. It doesn't matter whom you hire for a baseball operations job in a group of qualified candidates. If you get maybe three or five people whom you are considering for a job, they're all going to be roughly the same value. Assumption number two is that this is the correct method to employ the team you want to hire, that adding an additional employee will not give you any more value. And the third assumption is that the low wages are not turning better qualified people away from baseball. So let's look at all these assumptions a little bit more closely. This is the most important one, the homogeneity of value. This conception of the market works only if, as teams and analysts generally do, assume that baseball's employees are pretty much interchangeable. Going back to Cameron and Kusnick again, supply of qualified candidates is so high for Cameron, and Kusnick says, at some point you price yourself out and end up getting replaced by people who are the same as you were when you started. Now, that's, I think, a decent description of what happens in baseball sometimes, but it makes sense only if the difference in salary between the experienced employee and the new hire, which probably isn't going to be that much in the scheme of things to a professional baseball team, is worth more than the difference in value between the experienced hire and the new guy. So to go back to this highly technical drawing, seeing the market at this giant line of people who are all pretty much interchangeable makes sense only if this holds. But I don't think it really makes much sense. Just to use Moneyball as an example, I know it's outdated now, but I think it's something most of us are familiar with. I don't think it's possible to read that book without prior prejudices and not come away with the idea that certain members of the A's front office in 2002 were much better at their jobs than the people in baseball. And even if that exceptional talent is concentrated in a small minority of employees in baseball, that should be enough to shape the market. Think about how teams look at players. There are hundreds of people who have plausible chances of playing outfield for a baseball, major league baseball team this year, plus millions more who want to but you know, can't, because they're not good enough. For most of that group, they're pretty much interchangeable in their value. There are maybe you know some fractions of a win, but it's not going to make too much of a difference whom among them you sign or trade for or promote. But that didn't stop the Yankees from giving $150 million to Jacoby Ellsbury this year, because he's an exceptional talent, and the market is set for the premier hires by the minority of people who are exceptional. So assumption number two is the huge increasing returns to labor for baseball operations personnel. At any point in hiring baseball employees, given that the cost of a win, which was taken as the approximate value of a win, was $7 million, if you're worth even a tiny fraction of a win, that's valuable to a team. So a new employee would have to be almost literally worthless at this kind of current pay scale, no matter how many employees you're hiring, for the whatever the given level is to be correct. So if you can hire an entry-level employee for $35,000 a year, which maybe a little bit more or less depending on the team or the department, you're being paid as though you're worth 1/200th of a win. So if you are, an additional hire has to be worth less than 1/200th of a win for any equilibrium point in the labor market to be rational. Assumption three, this is the least important one, but it's at least worth mentioning, is that people who apply for jobs in baseball with low wages are just as qualified as people who would apply if the wages were more competitive with other industries. This makes sense in that you have to love baseball to be good enough to work in baseball, and if you love baseball, you're probably willing to take a salary cut to work in baseball. But on the other hand, for people whose positions require skills or qualifications that are not unique to baseball, the better you are at those positions, the better the job you get somewhere else. So the opportunity cost is higher for better qualified people in those kinds of more technical departments, meaning that the low salaries could be turning those people away from the game. So, how do we test the rationality of the market? If you know that those are the only conditions under which the market makes sense the way it is, if you have another explanation, I'd be happy to hear it. There are other reasons I've thought I've heard from other people about why the market could be the way it is, even if that's not true, but none that I'm convinced makes sense and rational. They're more excuses than logical reasons. So, my question is, how much is the variation in player investing skill at the GM level worth to a team per year, if it exists at all? And my hypothesis here is assumption number one, that front office employees are pretty much equal in value. Population of general managers, this endogenizes everyone below them, which is unfortunate in terms of actually assessing an individual person's value, but ultimately, it does sort of make sense if you think about it. Within most teams, the GM has the power to hire someone or to fire someone. It's up to him who to listen to, whose advice to choose over the others. Ultimately, the buck stops with the GM, even if it's not just all the GM doing the work. And the data here are creative signings and trades. This is just one facet of what a front office does, and I make no claims that this encompasses everything. But these are the decisions we can look at as free market transactions, to some extent, with free signings and trades. And there's specific decisions that a GM, if he didn't make it himself, then he signed off on it after delegating it to a senior advisor to make these decisions. So there's specific things we can look at with quantifiable results. So for free agent signings, I again went back from just after the last strike affected season to the end of this season. I looked at only signings which players earn MLB salaries, so minor league signings counted if the guys were promoted. If not, I figured their salaries were probably too minor to really make a difference to Tolkien's payroll. I looked at only signings of players with hit free agency since their signing, because I endogenized subsequent extensions in the original deal for this. The reason for that is that teams do value that monopoly on extensions. You see that in trades all the time. You see that in teams signing free agents to one-year deals to build themselves back up and extend them. That's something that teams value, so I decided it was better to endogenize them than to leave them out in the cold, since that's something teams care about. And for production, for return on investments, I use Fangraphs WAR for hitters and RA9 WAR from Fangraphs for pitchers, because ultimately, what matters is what happened. And there are complications with how much fit-based WAR really captures the pitcher's skill. But what matters is what happened. And if a GM got the results, that's based on what actually happened, not how good the pitcher was himself. So from return on investment, I here define, this looks fancy, but it's not. It's just the production the player produced over the life of his time under team control, times the value of that production, in a given year, divided by the salary here and over the course of the contract. Pretty simple stuff. For trades, I used a similar methodology of only trades in which the one player earned an MLB salary, and trades are all over now with no extensions left. I looked at only deals in which one player was traded for another player, so no waiver wire grabs, no cash considerations, just actual player-for-player trades. And I left out August and September deals, because the waiver process distorts the free market aspect that generally works for other trades. Here's the equation for return investment for trades. This looks even fancier, but it's not. This is just the numerator is the value of the production you got from all the guys for whom you traded, plus the salary you don't have to pay to the guys traded away, divided by the production of the guys you gave up, plus the salary you don't have to pay to the players you traded for, with adjustments for any cash transfers that occurred as part of the deal. I also want to note that I changed all negative WAR values for players to zero, so that we would eliminate negative return on investment that would impact both the team that screwed up and the team that did well. So there's a floor that's higher than usual, but that shouldn't affect the results too much, I wouldn't think. So I use random effects to analyze these models. For those of you who aren't familiar with random effects, it's basically like a fixed effect regression. But rather than just trying to fit all of the variables to the data as best as it can, it first assumes that all the variables you're looking at are part of a group or a couple of groups, if you put it up that way, and estimates the population distribution of that group, in this case of GMs, and estimates the population variance in a quasi-normal distribution, and then fits all the individual GMs to places on that curve. Random effects works for this better than fixed effect or something else because it assumes that they're all related. I don't think any general manager right now is paradigmatically better or paradigmatically worse than his peers. It considers the full population variance, so that we're looking at estimating an entire group of possible potential GM candidates and not just fitting to the ones we have observed. And it regresses individual results to the mean, so if a GM is, has good results or really bad results, it assumes that that's not just talent, that there might be some luck in there too. It's sort of an automatic regression to the mean component for that. So for free agent investing, the formula here is basically return on investment equals GM plus team. Added team in here, the GM is supposed to endogenize everyone below him, but the team is there to capture the owner. Some owners are more involved than others in running their teams, but given the free agents are just about money, the owner really does matter in decide, sometimes even telling the subordinates to sign players, sometimes just restricting the money that the GM has to work with. But that is an important component there. For trades, the check return on investment equals GM. And that's because I got a singular convergence error when I ran it with both the GM and the team, because there weren't enough instances of GMs and teams being matched with different GM for teams. But it also kind of makes sense that teams wouldn't matter much above the GM for trades, because owners typically are not as involved with trades as they are for free agent signings, because it's not just about money, it's about players and both sides giving up something in return. For what it's worth, I did this with fixed effects too for both versions, and I got significant coefficients for both GMs and teams for free agent signings and fixed effects, but only for GMs when I ran it with teams too for trades. So I think it's fair to leave them out of the equation here. So we got equations for return on investment, but what do we do with that? That's just an arbitrary number. So I calculated some multipliers to convert the return on investment to tangible values. So for free agent signings, I added up everyone in baseball this past season who had experienced free agency and was playing either under a free agent contract or a contract that he had signed subsequent to signing the free agent. And the average team spent $47.2 million on free agents, or people acquired via free agency this past year. For trades, I looked at trade investment the same way I did for the equation before, with adding up WAR with zeros, negative change to zero, just to be consistent, and salaries together. And with that number, the average team, if you include the value of the production as just money, average team spent $111 million on trade investments this past year. So, what you've all been waiting for are the results. One standard deviation of free agent investing ability at the GM level, and again, this endogenous is right below the GM, worth 40% of a team's return on investment for free agents, which the average team works out to $19 million in surplus value, which means that the one standard deviation of improvement in free agent signing ability for the average team investment gives you an extra 2.5 wins to 3 wins per year once the GM is there long enough to control that. For trades, 31% return on investment with a greater multiplier. So the average team with average trade investments with a GM who is one standard deviation better at trading, or GM and subordinates, will get 5 extra wins per year worth of value out of that investment. It's important to remember, again, this is everyone below the GM too, it's not just the individual himself, and it would take time for a GM to fully shape a roster. You can interpret these numbers as what it would be like once the GM is there long enough to fully shape the roster in his own image. Or you can also think of it as the total effect he will have on his team even after he's gone, divided by the years he's there. You should think about it as a lag, thing like that. So, let's see these scores here. If you are starting with a GM with below average value, which is on the left, and you are improving to a better one on the top, that's how many wins you can expect to see from improvements in free agency for a given year. Once the GM has been there long enough to take over. So if you are, say, half the standard deviation below with your current GM, and you improve to one who's one standard deviation above, you are getting 4 wins without spending any more money, just by having someone who's investing it more intelligently. For trades, it's even bigger, because we have a bigger standard deviation, so the Z-scores are higher. If you go to that same improvement from one who's half standard deviation below to a full standard deviation above, you're talking about 7.5 wins of improvement per season just from hiring this new general manager. And if you combine them, and it's difficult to do both well, but one standard deviation of both, if you combine both of them together, it's worth 7.6 wins a year, or $53 million in the 2013 league market, which will only increase as salaries continue to inflate. So if you look at, again, a GM who's half standard deviation below average of both, replacing him with someone who is one standard deviation better at both, you have 11.4 wins a season of improvement for that GM, which is worth quite a bit of money. So this model also calculates individual results, and I want to caution that for various reasons this model isn't great at estimating individual results. That's not what it was designed to do. It was supposed to be for the population. But if you look, one of these lists is the top 10 most valuable GMs according to this model, and one is the least valuable GMs according to this model. And I think you can probably figure out which is which. And the difference between Larry Beinfest, the best GM of the last 19 years according to this model, and Jim Beattie, who is the worst, works out to 12 wins of expected value per year, or $86 million, which is a lot. So, how do we generalize these results? If you take 7.6 wins, our best estimate for one standard deviation of GM value, which that includes everyone below the GM, but it also doesn't count anything that GM does besides trade and free agent signings. If you look at assistant GM, GM, or maybe a director of scouting or player development to have a big impact on the team. If you want to say that he or she can have maybe a quarter of the impact that the GM has, what kind of deviation of senior executive level ability is worth 2 wins a year, or about $14 million in last year's market? If you want to look at 10% of the level, I'm kind of making these numbers up, but maybe the director of analytics or a junior level scouting director, that's almost a win of standard deviation per year for at that level. Maybe a scout or a junior level assistant in a department, if you're talking about 5% of that level, sounds about right to me, maybe that standard deviation is almost half of a win. So we're still talking about multiple millions of dollars for one standard deviation of front office ability. And at 1% of that level, maybe an intern who has real responsibility, a single standard deviation is a tenth of a win, which doesn't sound like much, but if teams are paying $7 million per win, then you can very easily see that the best intern could be worth more than $1 million of value to your team per year. I know it's not realistic that intern will make $1 million, but it's significant that there is that potential for difference with the people you hire. So, I want to be very clear, because what I told you when I saw this, I was shocked by it. I want to be very, very clear with the caveats of this study. I can't tell you how much of this variation is the GM himself and how much of it is everyone below him. The ability to make your own investments and have your own insight and to synthesize that of others, those are two different skills, and I can't from the outside pull them apart. I can't tell you how much variation there is other facets of a GM's job. These are the most visible things a GM does, but they're not the only thing a GM does. I can't tell you with confidence how much any individual GM is worth, and I can't tell you any specifics about other front office employees. So, sorry, I wasted all your time. Here's what I can tell you. Remember this yellow slide? So you can remember that. Assumption one, if there is no significant heterogeneity in value among the serious candidates for any front office position, I think these numbers mean that that's disproven. Assumption number two, that it's not worth a team's while to hire anyone more than they're currently hiring in the market right now. Given that the range of value for a front office employee is so large and the cost is so small, I can't directly test this because I don't know what the diminishing marginal return effect is, but this seems dubious that it wouldn't be worth paying the market wage for someone who could be worth millions of dollars before you account for the diminishing marginal returns. And the third assumption about low salaries driving away more qualified candidates, I can't address that at all. I'll just say that it's probably incorrect. I'll be honest about this. But all that is enough to mean that this model here, this is wrong. And it shouldn't be the way people think about front office personnel. What that means, a rational conception of the labor market for front office employees or anyone who works in baseball and doesn't actually play the game, could be a manager, coaches, trainers, anyone really who affects the players at all, should look dramatically different than the typical conception. Some symptoms of a more rationally conceived market, again, I can't tell you the specifics of what this would be, but you'll probably see more competitive bidding for respective hires. The best candidates should have multiple teams trying to talk each other's offers until you bid up the prices so they match their values. Higher and different salaries for baseball operations personnel you shouldn't be willing to pay someone only what the market is paying them if they're better than their peers. And generally larger front office staffs, if employee that is valuable, then teams should probably hire more of them. Big takeaway here is that extra dollars spent on front office talent in the current market will go further than extra dollars spent on players. Now, I hate the phrase the next money ball. I don't know why it's a pet peeve of mine, I don't like it. But if you're looking for the next money ball, it's front office employees, anyone who works for a team who doesn't actually get on the field, because you're going to buy your wins much more cheaply if you do so with non-players than you get them with players. And if you're looking for actionable results, your team should consider employees and prospective hires worth in terms of their concrete, actual value to the team. I don't know how you actually measure that internally with how many wins you think an employee is worth. I don't leave you with that mystery. But to think about it in terms of how many wins do I get with him or her, and how easily can I replace him or her? And whatever that difference is, that's how much you should be willing to pay to that employee. You should bid up wages for potential hires until their salary offers exceed their values. So if someone's worth $1 million in value, which is about a tenth of a win, and they're making $30,000, or they have an offer from the team for $30,000, why would you offer them $40,000? Still making a 2,500% return on investment for that. And be the first to take advantage of this market inefficiency. Because if this market corrects itself, you'll be the first to do it, so you can get these people for slightly above the current market wages, and not wait until everybody else has jumped on and reduced these salaries further. I want to thank, there are people who have helped me with this, too many to list here. I want to thank Brown for helping send me out here, my thesis advisor, Ken Shea, Matt Schwartz and Stephen Loftus, who's here. Thank you for your invaluable help. Gary Cohen with Baseball Cube, who gave me the data dump that started this transaction database. And then basically every baseball site website there is, PRF, Baseball Almanac, Fangraphs. If you've ever heard of it, I used it, and I'm sure I've used things that you haven't heard of to fill in this database, this missing data. So thank you to anyone associated with any of those sites. And thank you to Saber for giving me this opportunity to speak at this conference.
I have two questions. The first question is, when you were figuring out the value of the general manager, you gave that, I forgot what it was, and I may have missed this. Did you look at if that general manager weren't there, what a replacement general manager would yeah. contribute? Did that number include that?
No, I don't have a good number for what a replacement level GM is, because they're all mixed together and I don't know. I don't have a definitive value for who the best ones are, so I can't tell you what the replacement level one is. If you go back to the Z-scores, I would think maybe like a GM who's 1 to 2 standard deviations below average is probably what your replacement level is. But with so many qualified candidates out there, I don't know what the replacement level would be. You'd have to think of it more in terms of what the team has or what the other options would be. The replacement level would be based on the alternatives that would be specific to a team, at least in its own estimation. So I don't have a concrete value for what the placement level is.
And I guess my second question, and I'll give you context where I'm coming from. I'm an inside labor lawyer. I'm curious why general managers under the NLRA cannot organize because they hire, fire, and whatnot. But the rest of the staff could. And Major League Baseball players before Marvin Miller were greatly exploited. And it's really helped everybody. I'm just curious, did it ever come into your mind a way of increasing the wages for the front office staff would be for them to be in union. So there would, there is some kind of floor that management has to pay them because they undervalue owners, the skills of these really sought after employees. Did you think of it? And would you think of that to be possible?
I thought of that, or I hadn't thought of that, but thinking about it now. The way the teams currently think of the market, where everybody's interchangeable, it's that, go back to that quote from Joshua Kusnick, the teams always have the advantage. Because if you're thinking about the market and everyone is replaceable, then you have, if you unionize and try to get more wages, they'll fire you and hire someone else.
They can't, it's against the law to do that.
I see.
If you unionize, they can't fire you. Most union contracts have just cause. You can't be fired without just cause. If you choose
right.
That
wouldn't happen. Okay. If you're talking about people who are on one-year contracts, which not everyone in baseball is, but a lot of people are, then if you demanded a raise and they weren't willing to pay it, they'd just let you go.
I'm not trying to, but it's interesting you're bringing this up, but how it would work is the front office of all Major League Baseball teams would unionize, it would be a three-year contract, and it would be a floor. You would have to pay each person that amount of money. This increase, years 1, 2, 3, and then they can't fire you. They're supposed to get just copying, but they can pay you above the floor. So it would change the whole dynamic.
That might work. I don't know enough about how that would work to speculate on whether that would be a good solution, but it's interesting.
First of all, thanks for this really fascinating piece of work, and hopefully it's something you'll continue to build on, and perhaps even other researchers will build on at some point. Help me reconcile something that I think I heard.
Sure.
Two things I think I heard, and I'm probably not making the right connection, but in the beginning you talked about how if the marginal revenue product of a win is $3 million, but the market rate is $1 million per player, there's no reason why you should pay more than $1 million. So when you take that to your front office example, why is it then that regardless of the value of a general manager's organization, because that's really what you're talking about, right, the whole organization, Why should someone be willing to pay more than the market rate?
Sure. Because the market rate assumes that everyone is basically the same who works in baseball operations or could work in baseball operations. And the point is that if there are significant differences in terms of their concrete value to the team, if you could get someone who is maybe a tenth of a win more valuable for $10,000 more, then that is still, you're paying above market wage, but you are getting a better investment of that. You're getting more for your money that way.
Yeah, I got it. The part I was forgetting was that we don't have the war.
Correct.
For the front office yet.
Right.
Although you're making inroads in that area. So it's not, yeah, it's on a per win basis already at the player level. We don't have that at the,
correct,
at the front office level.
Yeah.
That's the link between the two. Yeah, thanks. Terrific.
It would be fantastic. Two questions. The first is, and maybe I missed this, the general managers on your list, the general managers who were worth more because they generated more value for trades and free agent signings versus the ones that were less. How do you know that that's not just random chance? How robust were your regression results?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. That's why I don't put much stock in the individual results. There are a few reasons why the model doesn't work well for individuals. Among them is sample bias. So the most notable example for this was Billy Beane. Because I knocked out every trade that isn't over yet, if you looked at Billy Beane's trade record, all of his signature trades are still going. Like both of the Dan Heron trades are still going, the Gio Gonzalez trades are still going, the Carlos Gonzalez trades. All the trades that you think of when you think of Billy Beane, they're just not in the model yet because they're still going. We're judging the record that on which they're being judged is selective, often towards the eliminating the best signings or trades, which are the ones that are going to last longer.
And the second question is, assuming arguendo that your assumption about homogeneity is not true, that certain front office personnel are better than others, and especially if we're talking about people other than general managers, because that seems to be where this is directed, how would a general manager or an owner, how would you know who they are?
I don't have a good answer for that, other than I would expect. Think about scouting in baseball. You don't need stats to tell you who the best players are. I mean, it definitely helps, but you can identify the best ones. It's harder for front office personnel because you don't get to see all their work every day because most of it is secret or too trivial at the time, seeming to be public. But you can at least get a sense, I think, of what your own people are worth. You can get a sense of who the best people are. I think if you ask anyone working for a team who the best, you know, a group of the best scouting directors or analytics guys, whatever, they could give you a list that would probably be pretty consistent reasonably from team to team. You also have the uncertainty argument is one of the things that people suggested for why salaries are below market value, if this is the case. And that's definitely, you don't want to pay someone like he's worth half of a win if you don't know that he's worth half of a win, even if that's what you think his expected value is. But no one in any industry knows what you're worth before you get hired. And there are still other industries don't have the problem of, we don't know exactly what you're worth, so we're not going to pay you what you get in another industry. And also, you look at a guy like a premium GM, like just looking at Theo because he's the highest paid GM. When he went to the Cubs weren't wondering, I don't know how good this guy is. They went out and got him because they wanted him. They thought he was the best. Guys with established track records like that, I'm not sure how the uncertainty argument holds up that well.
So this is just more of a minor detail because I want to understand your model a little bit better. So how did you define original signing and how and why was it endogenous again?
Oh, sure. So the original signing was, I did this differently for the cost of a win than for the actual free agent signing investments. Cost of a win, I looked only at the open market because I wanted to see what teams were paying when they had to bid against each other to drive up the prices or let the prices fall. For the free agent investment model, I looked at the original signing was when the player signed with the team. And that contract, the way I categorized it, lasted until he hit free agency again or retired and was released. So if he were extended, that counted in the original signing because I could have gone either way on that. I've certainly argued with myself about that. But one of the things that teams do value is having that control, or the monopoly on extending control if they so choose to take it.
When you were answering your question earlier about the GMs, you were mentioning how the trades for people such as Dan Heron and other players were continuing to be in effect because they kept the players they were traded for still with the team or were traded for other people.
Sure.
I've seen that used in several studies before and as articles before. And my question I've always had is, does that make sense? Is it in the sense of, when a GM makes a trade, are they, with that trade, are they assuming at that point that, yes, at some point we're going to be trading this player, or are they approaching it with, we are expecting to keep this player until they reach free agency? That could affect whether that assumption holds true.
So I guess my response to that would be that player takes on a certain market value when you, or whatever, he plays between the original trade and the second trade, or the not trade. And presumably, I guess the assumption is that he will again be traded at his market value, so that you are acquiring that asset who is worth some number of wins or dollars, and that he will be worth something like that even if you trade him again, if you're making a fair trade. I suppose that you could, if a GM is consistently good at making trades, or anyone below him, you could say that effect is compounded and that actually maybe underestimates some trading skill if you are consistently multiplying your investments. That's a good idea. Is that it? Okay, thank you so much.